few goblets of champagne. When it was time to go, Tess put me in my Mazda and asked me if I was okay, which I felt I was, until driving back home to the valley. I tackled the curving roller coaster, that is, Coldwater Canyon. God help me, I had to pull over twice to pee and vomit in the dark bushes. It was the first time I knew what blind drunk meant. I could see only the yellow lines, and I followed them slowly all the way to my right turn on Victory and left on Troost. When I stumbled into the small apartment, Roxanne said, "Damn, Jenny, you smell like a distillery." Never, ever did that again. After a few months, I began to get anxious about work. I wasn't getting cast in anything. A big mouth and a deep back bend weren't cutting it in Hollywood. I had signed with ICM for movie and TV work on the West Coast. But a string of unsuccessful auditions led Iris Grossman, my agent at the time, to tell me to get out of the business. This is not exactly what you want to hear from your agent. Tess was also getting frustrated with my failure to secure any jobs. Clutching at straws, she bitchily told me I needed to lose weight. "You're in Hollywood now." I wasn't obese by any stretch, not even chubby. In fact, my strength and flexibility were two great assets that had served me well. But the pressure to meet the size 2 Hollywood standard was real. I questioned more and more if I could cope, because I was not centered or prepared. I had not yet trained to audition for screen roles. I was used to playing to live audiences. And now, I had to pull everything back for the camera. I hadn't acted in a long time. To develop a character for a role required more focus than my scattered mind was able to muster. I found it difficult to concentrate. My mind was always racing off in tangents. I became homesick for New York City. I especially wanted to be in Central Park's Sheep Meadow in mid-August to participate in the global meditation marking the harmonic convergence, a big event in the New Age movement. The importance of the date had to do with the Mayan calendar and a prediction of something big and transformative happening, signaled by an alignment of the sun and planets on August 16, 1987. Some believed the spectacle would usher in a new era for humanity. Well, that turned out to be bullshit. The first thing I did when I returned to New York was see Thomas, but being with him was a drag. He was really worried that we'd never get married because I was now living in Los Angeles. But he was still telling me not to curse and to act like a lady. Thomas had good reason to be worried. I was jetting back and forth between the East and West Coast for auditions and meetings, taking acting class, performing in nightclubs, and sleeping with a few other guys in New York and Los Angeles. The harmonic convergence did not seem to extend to my crazed ass. To relieve my anxiety and try to get a grip on my life, I continued to search for answers by immersing myself in popular spirituality. Rolfing, crystals, chakra cleansing, totems, channeling, past life regression, and on and on and on. I reread Mandino's The Greatest Salesman and became motivated by Shakti Gawain's creative visualization, which spelled out how to manifest your dreams. A few of these approaches helped me immensely, although they didn't solve the underlying problem. I also was consuming titles such as Overcoming the Fear of Success by Martha Friedman and Love Yourself into Life by Jay-Z Knight. I had begun to build my West Coast corral of lovers. First with a man named Tim, who pulled out his huge dick and said, "Not bad for a white guy, huh?" After Tim, my stable of men grew as I began to date Gary, a musician, as well as Aaron, Jeff, and Peter. Dick. The men weren't human. They were my tool, my drug. My need for the euphoria of the orgasm was acute. I was starting to think there was something off about my behavior, but I felt compelled to have sex. It was the best way I knew how to calm my anxiety. I could no longer deny the fact that I was fucked up in deep, fundamental ways that were too overwhelming to contemplate. It was becoming more difficult to overlook my extreme, abiding depression, or to deny that my clowning and promiscuity were, in fact, inappropriate behavior. I wanted to be different, to take control of my life, and I did find hope. Many of the books I read gave me new perspectives and new self-help tools for becoming the person I wanted to be. The Seth books by James Roberts were hugely important to me. The themes they addressed made me increasingly convinced that maintaining positivity and staying focused on what I wanted instead of what I did not want would enable me to manifest the life I sought. My metaphysical studies taught me that energy is highest where the water meets the land. So I booked myself a weekend at Gurney's Inn, a historic spa resort in Montauk, on the tip of Long Island, New York. The sunset was magical as I stood on the rocky shoreline. It seemed the perfect setting for manifesting, and each time the waves crashed against the rocks, I shouted, "I want a job in Hollywood!" The next day, I lay in a darkened spa room, mummy-like, in a seaweed mineral wrap. I heard the attendant enter, sensed her bending close to me, and softly whisper, "Someone's calling from Los Angeles, Miss Lewis. I believe it's Hollywood." The moment felt just like one of those scenes in an old movie where the actress gets the call that changes her life. "Hollywood calling?" The attendant had a phone on a long cord and held the receiver to my ear as I said, "Hello," through the mud that restricted my face. Bob Wax was on the line shouting from excitement that I had to catch the earliest flight to Los Angeles because a producer named Chaim Saban wanted me to audition for a pilot called Love Court. There was a limousine already waiting for me, which drove me back to my apartment and idled at the curb while I hurriedly packed. On the way to JFK Airport, I had the limo stop briefly at Thomas's apartment to pick up a few things I had left there. Thomas said, "How long will you be gone this time?" I said, "Baby, this might be it." I saw his face and thought to myself, "Let the fucking limo wait." I held his face in my hands and kissed him. He drew back just a little. I could see he was trying to cover the heartbreak he was feeling. I felt bad, but I didn't feel horrible, because I had never lied to him. He knew this day would come. We had a sweet and powerful quickie. And like the gentleman he always was, he carried my luggage to the limo and waved me off. You're wondering if I cried in that limo. The answer's yes, and the 5 hours on the fucking plane. I had just ended a 7-year relationship, and by the time I got back to Roxanne's apartment, my whole body was itching. The next morning, I broke out in red welts, and my entire body was sore. This had never happened to me before. I was sure it was AIDS. I couldn't get to the doctor fast enough. Roxanne and I were holding hands when the doctor came into the room. He asked me if I had been under heavy stress. I looked at him like he was a damn fool and told him I had just gotten a divorce. He said, "Well, this is very common. You have shingles." I had remembered playing hopscotch with torn shingles from the rooftop in Kinloch made of sand and tar. Good Lord, what a come around, and what a hideous name for a hideous ailment. I proceeded to skip my happy, itchy ass to the car and take my scratchy, itchy ass home. From the Los Angeles Times, November 27th, 1987. Jennifer Lewis has been appointed to the bench in Love Court, a new syndicated half-hour series to premiere in September 1988. Lewis, an actress, will dispense opinions to couples wrangling over romantic problems. The series is described as a comedy takeoff on TV's Divorce Court, People's Court, Superior Court, and Love Connection. And here it was, my first television gig. After we shot the pilot for Love Court, things got really busy for me during the next few months. But not in Hollywood. Once again, Irv Rabel came to me with a great opportunity. This time, a concert in Paris, featuring me and several wonderful singers, Sharon McKnight, Lena Katrakis, Naomi Moody, and Nancy Lamont. On the way to Paris, I stopped in New York for a few days, and Thomas asked me to marry him. I said yes. When I told Mama, she said, "There's no way you're marrying anybody." While in Paris, I became friendly with our pianist, Michael Skloff, and his wife, Marta Kaufman. When we got back to the States, Marta and her creative partner, David Crane, cast me in a musical called Let Freedom Sing, which played in Philly and then at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Completely forgetting I was engaged, I simply couldn't resist the adorable young doorman at the Kennedy Center. I was his first, and I pity the poor girl who was his second. Nobody could follow the acrobatics I performed after he escorted me into the elevator and I pulled the stop button. I returned to L.A. and had good auditions for shows on CBS and ABC and at MTM, which was Mary Tyler Moore's production company. It was disappointing when the Love Court pilot didn't get picked up. But nonetheless, things were moving in the right direction, and stardom seemed within reach. More opportunities came along, including a pilot with Eddie Murphy called What's Alan Watching?, which unfortunately did not make it to the airwaves. Around this time, I went on a date with Eddie's brother, Charlie Murphy. I swear I didn't touch him, y'all. We laugh so much, I think we just forgot to screw. In March 1990, I was cast in my first regular television role on Crosstown. The series star was Tony Alda of the famous Alda acting family. I was nervous as hell. It was the first time I had acted on camera on a consistent basis. During the second day of filming, the director stopped me mid-scene. He shouted, "What are you doing?" "This is a soundstage, Jennifer, not a theater stage." I had been trained to hit the back row of a large theater. But when the director showed me the footage of my performance, the problem was clear. I came across loud, over the top, exaggerated, like a kabuki actor among regular people. See, the camera is intimate. It sees more keenly than the eyes of an audience 10 feet away. On stage, you have to tell the truth. On camera, you have to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Anything less comes across as fake acting. We call it acting. I realized that in order to deliver that much truth, I had to know the truth of who I was. It meant I had to take that journey within. I wanted to please the director. I wanted to be as great in Hollywood as I had been in college and on Broadway. I had to play to the intimacy of a camera and a few people in my face. Not a cabaret full of nightclubbers at a distance. I listened as the crosstown directors helped me. And I did the work. I dove all the way in. And it was a hell of a transition, y'all. Stanislavski, The Method, acting classes with the brilliant Janet Alhanty served as a sort of therapy for me. Because I was forced to examine my emotions in order to create the authentic emotions for the characters I played. The greatest method actors achieved unity with their characters. Marlon Brando, Denzel Washington, Viola Davis. They say Robert De Niro comes to set with a stack of index cards of notes he has rooted out about his character. I focused on my crosstown character. How could I create her truth? I was so proud the day that same director yelled, "Cut!" and then smiled at me. Very good, Jennifer. Working on a TV series is no joke. Like running a marathon every day. Great actors make it look easy. Trust me. It is not. Sometimes we start at 5 or 6 in the morning and shoot 2 episodes in a single day. A couple of times, Tony Alda and I stayed at the studio overnight. I was exhausted during Crosstown, but I was very happy. Despite our failed engagement, Thomas and I were still on the makeup-to-breakup treadmill. We flew to Hawaii together for a vacation, hoping the beautiful setting would help heal our differences. Conveniently, we both forgot that our trip to Jamaica had failed at achieving that goal. We boarded a helicopter to sightsee over Kauai. The helicopter lowered itself down into the canyon, surrounded by all sizes and types of waterfalls. Absolutely gorgeous. Then as the helicopter ascended upward, the song, "Love Lift Us Up Where We Belong," blasted through the headphones they had given us. It was utterly breathtaking and romantic. I reached my right hand to take his left. Thomas was left-handed, and I didn't feel his sweet fingers reach back for mine. I turned to discover he was writing a note. I remember mouthing to him over the music, "What are you writing?" He said, "I just want to remember to tell my mother what I saw today." God help me. His mama always came first. Would I ever really be able to be number 2 for any man? I'm gonna let y'all answer that and keep it moving. I came to find the scenic hills and dramatic ocean views on the West Coast calming to my soul. They say nobody walks in Los Angeles, but one of the joys of living here is hiking. From my first days as a resident, when I felt confused, I would hike the mountains that frame the San Fernando Valley. Sometimes singing a song that was my favorite when I was a little girl. Climb every mountain, ford every stream, follow every rainbow, till you find your dream. I choose the steepest slopes, singing a gospel phrase I love that went, God, give me mountains with hills at their knees. Mountains too high for the flutter of trees. God, give me mountains and strength to climb them. This was a soul-searching time for me. I sought to be more connected to nature, to pay more attention to sunsets and the rising of the moon. I ran into Bet one day while hiking the Hollywood Reservoir with my friend Tom Fennessy. She had just started work on a new movie, which turned out to be Beaches. She got me a featured role in a number written by Mark Shaman called Otto Titzling, a fictional account of the invention of the bra, wherein my already oversized bosom was costumed in outrageously huge falsies. During a break, Mark, Bette, and I walked out onto Wilshire Boulevard. Still in full costume, I stepped to the curb where I pretended to hitchhike while bouncing up and down to jiggle the enormous breasts. We three fell out at the faces of passing drivers. When I wasn't working, I grasped for anything that might help me feel whole. Crystals, face readings, moon baths, the Ouija board. What a mess I was. Longing for Thomas, longing for Miguel. Confused as to why I was not elated at the progress of my career. God help me, nothing was ever enough. And of course it didn't help that I was having sex with far too many men, Adam, Tim, Tucker, and Eddie. Green, not Murphy. Tucker introduced me to porn, but I never really liked it. It gave me a headache. The video showed too much banging and not enough foreplay. The action always looked too painful to me. Okay, you know, I like a little hair pulling, but not all that oversized extra. You know you're bored with porn when you find yourself criticizing the acting skills of the participants. Tucker also introduced me to the waterbed thing. He liked waterbeds because he had back problems courtesy of the Vietnam War. All that splashing around spoiled the rhythm. I pretended to fall on the floor so we could finish up on solid ground. I discovered how annoying it was to have sex wearing Lee press-on nails. I had to wear them for a television show, but they made sex difficult. A few men complained. Poor bastards. I flew to New York for an audition, and while there, made an appearance at a few of my old haunts, including Possible 20. Journal entry. Rude waitress tells me Elaine Swain is dead. Horrible moment. I returned to the West Coast and was in a downward spiral for weeks. The inevitable breaking point came after a huge long-distance fight with Thomas the day before I had an important audition for a role on 30-something. The drama series about yuppie angst that was the hottest show on television at the time. I was already in emotional distress when I arrived for the audition at a nondescript office building. My scene was with Peter Horton, the director and one of the show's stars. Right from the start, things went south. I was auditioning for the character of Rosie, but was drowning in the character of Jennifer Lewis and wearing a mask. I felt like my entire career depended on this one audition. A crushing weight that made it impossible for me to focus on the character or remember the lines. I became overwrought for the first time in my life and said, I can't do it. Peter Horton was lovely. Yes, you can, Jennifer. I started over, but simply could not get the words out. I thanked Peter, and barely holding myself together, walked blindly out of the room. As soon as I stepped into the elevator, I completely lost all control, sobbing and gulping as I slid down the wall and melted into a puddle on the floor. The suit-clad people in the little compartment just looked at me. Back in my Mazda and still sobbing uncontrollably, I could barely see the road as I drove over Lar Canyon. When the red light stopped me at Ventura Boulevard, I collapsed on the steering wheel. I looked up when I heard two beeps from the car adjacent to mine. The older white driver looked at me compassionately, and I could see him mouth, "I'm sorry." It was just the sweetest little toot-toot on his horn, and a simple acknowledgement. I had been seen by this stranger, and it uplifted me, just enough to get home. Everything was crashing in on me. I spent a lot of time alone watching rented movies on my VCR. One of these was Francis, starring Jessica Lange. It was about Francis Former, a mostly B-movie actress during the 1930s and 1940s. Sadly, she was famous largely for having been the victim of an involuntary lobotomy following a diagnosis of manic depressive disorder. From the first scenes, Lange's brilliant portrayal of Francis Former's descent into mental illness triggered recognition in me, especially her crippling depression. The dark cloud that lay over her very existence, her impatience and impulsiveness, her loneliness, her inability to handle failure, her blaming others for her own mistakes. It was all familiar. I cried through the entire movie. Subconsciously, I knew it was my story. But still, I did not, could not, acknowledge that I, too, could be mentally ill. I turned the video off with one thought. Damn, I don't want to be like that. I never mentioned my reaction to Francis to anyone. I convinced myself that I could make myself better on my own and continue to search for answers in metaphysical spirituality. Around this time, I got a call from Shirley LaFleur, the dean of students while I was at Webster. Shirley, a wonderful poet and excellent dean, had been extremely supportive of me in college. As a freshman, I went to her office in tears because every time I do something that gets applause, people steal it. Shirley didn't make fun of me or patronize me. Instead, she said, "Jennifer, you should be flattered, because by the time they've stolen your material, you've gone on to create something new anyway." Shirley was my connection to Beverly Heath. They had been best friends in St. Louis. Shirley had flown out to Beverly's house in Pasadena for a few days. Like me, she was a native Kenlochian. As soon as I met Beverly and her family, I knew I had found home. Beverly is a social worker, an artist, and her husband, Albert Tootie Heath, is a world-renowned percussionist and was a member of the acclaimed Heath Brothers Jazz Group. Beverly drew me into her circle of friends, which to this day I credit for saving my life. They were educated, professional women who came together on a regular basis to exhale, share their stories, eat, laugh, and support one another. They were the most sophisticated women I had ever socialized with. Several were therapists or social workers. Their talk of politics, their Afrocentric clothing, and their worldliness were new to me. I wanted to drink up every drop of this wisdom. Tootie, observing how Beverly and her friends kept one another afloat, dubbed the group the Boat. These women were mighty ships. Some were freighters, others were tall ships with sails. They became new mother figures for me. Beverly, along with Jean King, Dr. Medria Williams, Ozhar, Myra Lebo, and Dr. Barbara Richardson, gave me levels of practical, professional, and spiritual guidance that I had never encountered before. I was the youngest member and the entertainer of the group. But the women cut me no slack when it came to honestly assessing my life. When I regaled them with stories of my sexual escapades, they laughed, but clearly grew tired of hearing me proclaim again and again, "I'm a star and dick is my life." And when I described some of the esoteric methods, such as trans-channeling and tarot cards, that I believed could help me find direction, Beverly told me, "Jenny, I don't believe none of that shit. You need to carry your ass to therapy." I half nodded, feigning interest. My lack of political consciousness was appalling to my Boat sisters, who had spent their lives in the civil rights movement. They pressed me. "What's in there, Jennifer? What is your foundation and purpose?" Echoes of Miguel's, "You say no thing," rang in my head. One of the members of the Boat, a family therapist named Jean King, took me to address a group of teenage mothers she was counseling in East L.A. The young women seemed hungry for stories about my career, my travels, and hardships. In turn, it was gratifying to hear them open up and speak honestly. The afternoon became a very sweet memory for me. Fast forward to 2016, when I'm at a track meet with my great-nephews somewhere on the outskirts of Los Angeles. I was leaving the stadium. Someone called to me, "Miss Lewis!" I turned, expecting the greeting had come from a fan requesting a picture. But instead, the smiling 40-ish woman immediately launched into her story. "Miss Lewis, I don't know if you remember me, but about 25 years ago, you came and spoke to a group of us who had just had babies. I was the one that was really quiet and sad because I wasn't ready to be a mother, and they had made me keep the baby." My heart started to melt as she continued. "I never forgot that day, and I always hoped that I would meet you again to thank you. You went around the room and asked us what our favorite song was. When you got to me, you said, 'Why don't you sing it for us?' I did. And I've been singing ever since, Miss Lewis. My baby's all grown now. I got two more out on the track, and my husband's up in the bleachers." She looked at me meaningfully and said, "And I'm doing all right, Miss Lewis. Doing real good." I've learned in life that what you give others is what provides the most value to your life. There I was, a mess myself, yet I still had something to offer that would have an effect on another person's world. Shortly after being embraced by the women of the Boat, I received some of the worst news possible. The love of my life, Miguelito Hermonguez Hinguez Gomez, had died of a massive heart attack after leaving Washington Square Park, where he had played his last game of chess. It had been about 6 years since I'd seen Miguel. He had aged, but he was still fawing and still mawing. I had sublet my apartment in New York, so we went to a hotel near the Museum of Natural History. It was a dump, and they dared to charge $120 a night. But we knew we wanted to be together, We were kind of shy with each other at first. But God help me, it was a one-thrust orgasm for us both. That's love. The next morning, I walked him to the train station. Before he went down the dirty staircase to the end train, he turned back and said, "You have to have some babies, Yennefer, so you'll have something to live for when you get old." The fact that I needed psychological help became even more evident after losing Miguel. During my nervous breakdown following my visit to Quitman's hospital room, Beverly told me, "There's no greater journey than the journey within." Her words touched me deeply. I trusted and loved her enough to know that I should follow her advice. I agreed to let Beverly help me find a therapist. It's one thing to decide that therapy can help you, but it's another thing to actually take the necessary steps to get it. I had a few good auditions and callbacks, making it easy to just put the therapy thing on the back burner. One day as I packed up 6 loads of laundry I had done at Beverly's house, she really pushed me about it. Feeling guilty, I got home, picked up the Yellow Pages, and randomly chose the name of a woman psychotherapist nearby. A few days later, I entered the therapist's elegant office, and we shook hands. She was confident and composed, her blonde hair carefully coiffed. As she asked me a question, I noticed the Harvard diploma on the wall. As my lengthy and increasingly intense response flowed forth, the therapist started inhaling deeply through her nose as if to manage her rising emotions. Her widening eyes seemed incapable of looking away from mine. I recall no details of the content of our conversation. But I swear, when I left 45 minutes later, her hair was sticking straight out like she had stuck a finger in a socket. She said, "We'll be in touch." She wasn't. Another boat member gave me the name of a middle-aged woman shrink whom her friend had been seeing for some time. But within 5 minutes, I knew that therapist was more depressed than I was. I felt frustrated by the whole damn thing. A nasty argument with Bob Wax and Tess over some bullshit sent me plummeting. Jesus, was I immature. I told Bob I had to be true to myself. He shouted back, "What the hell is that?" His scorn hurt me deeply. At this point, the dark night of the soul came to a head. There was nothing left but this masked entity. This life of the party who sobbed into her pillow every night. The depression was all-encompassing. Even as I raced through every day at full speed. Probably, I should not have attended the opening night party for the wonderful show Loretta Devine was starring in about Billie Holiday, called Lady Day, at Emerson's Bar and Grill. With several of my boat sisters, I drove down to San Diego, where the show opened at the famous Old Globe Theater. The party after the show was loud and boisterous. I got drunk and jumped up on the table, ordering everyone to shut the fuck up. The entire crew, especially my buddy Loretta, was soon falling out with laughter as I recounted my experience of searching for a therapist, adding all sorts of outrageous exaggerations. "Oh, honey, then they sent me to this fine black man who had been educated at Harvard, and he was poised to put me straight." I knew that the only thing that was gonna be straight was his back on that sofa with me straddling him. It was clear that I was an entertaining motherfucker and that something was wrong, especially when I wrapped up the mini-performance with a monologue about being so poor I lost my virginity to a rat. When I finished, Gene King pulled me aside and said, "Honey, you are about as crazy as you can be. Now, I have a friend I sent a schizophrenic to, and she worked wonders with him. Let me give you her number. I didn't even look at the paper Jean gave me before stuffing it in my cleavage. But at yoga class the next day, I began to sob uncontrollably. I went straight home and called that number. A few days later, when I met Jean's friend, Rachel, I was in an extremely agitated state. I could not look Rachel in the eyes and was unable to sit still. I dropped to the floor and began to do push-ups as she watched from her small armchair. She asked a couple of superficial questions. I batted them away as I rose from the floor to look out the window. Her incisive eyes followed me around the room, obviously assessing my every move. My modus operandi is to scare a bitch when I feel vulnerable, and I felt my hackles rise. She calmly told me to take a seat, which I did, on the back of the couch with my bare feet on the seat cushion. I responded to her next question dismissively. Then Rachel dropped the bomb. Tell me about your mother. Seeing red, I lunged off the couch into Rachel's face, yelling through clenched teeth and pounding my chest. I came here to talk about my career. Don't you ever mention my mother! 9. Kinlock. My earliest memory of Mama is her roughly pulling a white ruffled shirt over my head when I had measles. Mama, it hurts, I said, referring to the shirt on my tender skin. She softened, but just a bit. She had no time for coddling. Dorothy Mae Johnson Lewis, the eldest of 16 children, was herself mother of 7 by the age of 26. To say my mother was strong-willed and outspoken is an understatement. Once ADC, Welfare, sent a white male investigator to our house. When Mama opened the front door, the social worker peered in and said, "Nigga, how can you afford a piano?" Mama calmly said, "Just a moment," and closed the door. 30 seconds later, she reopened the door and threw a bucket of piss dead in his face. My mother was the sort who found my father in a bar with another woman and took his cash right on the spot. She told his date, "You're gonna buy your own drinks tonight because this money is going to feed his 7 kids." Edward James Lewis, my father, was a sharply dressed, good-looking man, the color of the walnuts that grew plentiful around town. The story goes that my mother was walking home from high school one day when Ed rode up on his bicycle, put her on the seat, rode her to a romantic spot, and proposed. She was 19 years old when they married in 1949. I arrived in 1957, after Willatrel, Vertrella, Larry, Edward, Babra, Robin, and Jackie. My parents separated when I was just 2 weeks old, and Daddy wasn't around a lot as I grew up. Like many men in Kinlock, Daddy drank. He was often out of work, again, like a lot of men in Kinlock, and when he did work, it was for low wages. Kinlock was the first self-governing black town in Missouri. We were a racially segregated island of poverty, surrounded by the white St. Louis suburbs, Berkeley and Ferguson. Yes, that Ferguson, where the murder of a young black man by a police officer in 2014 reinvigorated a nationwide movement against police violence. The Kinloch of my childhood consisted of little wood houses, some not more than shacks, outhouses and rocky roads. Most residents were so damn poor they couldn't afford to go to a doctor unless they were damn near dead. It seemed that people were always dying, just walking down the street or coming out of the Threaded Needle, the only legal bar in town. There were many underground juke joints that sold moonshine. Diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart attacks took out all kinds of folk, young and old. Drugs weren't pervasive during my formative years, but there were plenty of liquor stores, and alcoholism was the norm, along with violence and despair that often occur when people see no way out of their lives. No one could afford a gun, but there were plenty of knives, bricks, and baseball bats. People were always on edge in Kinloch, and a fight was always breaking out, sometimes right there at home. Don't get me wrong, there were a lot of good things about Kinloch, too, especially the benefit of growing up in an all-black town. The people in authority came from our community and were part of our culture. We had our own mayor, a police force, school system, post office, stores, and churches. Of course, everything but a bank. No need for a bank when no one had more cash than what was in their pocket. We had wonderful black teachers who cared that we were well-educated, and classes were small enough for this to be possible. Kinloch produced many high achievers, including Congresswoman Maxine Waters, entertainer and activist Dick Gregory, R&B singer Ann Peoples, and my good friend Beverly Heath. People knew each other in Kinloch. We were a tight community, with half of the folks in town related in some way. We sat on front porches, calling out to each other from the road or across the yard. We had some characters, too. There was Huckabuck, Cuckoo, Chicken Neck, the Pig Feet Man, and Cat Johnny, who always drove a Cadillac. We had a number of small shops and restaurants. Shack Pappies for barbecue, Hal's Drive-In for delicious garlic fried chicken, and Uncle Dick's, where we bought dill pickles, Lay's potato chips, and penny candy. My favorites were Mary Jane's, Nut Chews, and Watermelon Suckers. At Mr. Harris' store, we all tried to ignore the sweat that dripped off his head into the ice cream buckets when he bent to scoop cones for us. All the kids had their real mamas and one or two play mamas. When my mama was really struggling and our refrigerator was empty, I could stop by the house of any of my play mamas, Miss Barnes, Miss Clark, or Miss Benson. When I got real lucky, someone had made a tub of greens, or cornbread in a skillet, or a pot of neck bones. Mama hated being poor and dependent on government assistance. She was a proud woman and active in the church and community. Mama was a den mother for the Boy Scouts and even got involved in politics. She served as an election judge during the 1950s. She was ambitious for herself and for her kids. Shortly after I was born, she got job training and soon secured employment as a certified nursing attendant. When I was one, she found a job at St. Louis County Hospital where she worked until it closed in 1982. Even though Mama supplemented her hospital job by occasionally cleaning homes in the white suburbs, 8 mouths is a lot, and we were still very poor. When I was a toddler, we were forced to move into an old abandoned Baptist church on Jefferson Street to avoid homelessness. About 9 or 10 of Grandma's small 16 children were already living there. My family was in the basement, only 2 windowless rooms for Mama and the 7 of us kids. Mama strung a towel on a rod to separate our space from Aunt Louise's and her three kids. We shared a kitchen with them, and oh, you can imagine the drama, especially when there wasn't enough to eat for one family, let alone two. The church basement was dark and cramped, but my mother was an immaculate housekeeper. We slept three and four to a bed, and even though we had no windows, Mama hung curtains on the brick wall to make the place look as nice as she could. She kept our hair pressed, our clothes ironed, and made us use that milky white shoe polish on our tennis shoes every week. The Lewis children were always well-groomed. We were happy to move from the church to a creaky house on Wesley Street that had no hot water. Now that I was older, I had to use the outhouse. My ass froze on that seat in those sub-zero Missouri winters. The alternative was to do your business in a bucket in the house, which somebody had to carry out later. A coal stove in the middle room heated the entire small house. We'd huddle in front of the small black-and-white television to watch Godzilla, Abbott and Costello meet the Wolfman, or Frankenstein, with one of my favorites, Boris Karloff, on the one channel we could get. Good reception depended on adjusting a wad of aluminum foil around the antenna and giving the console a few shakes. Being the baby of the family was a drag. Everything I got was a hand-me-down, even bath water. After we heated pots of water on the stove, Latrella and Waletra would share the first tub. Then the boys, Edward and Larry, would do the same. Then Robin and Jackie would have a fresh tub to share. I used the same water after them. Lukewarm and dirty from two kids. I felt like an afterthought. The struggle was real. Economically, physically, and emotionally. Our house was oppressive. Not a happy place. There was always a sense of pressure from unseen outside forces that prevented us from having a nice house, new clothes, and plenty of toys, to the very identifiable fear that we would incur our mother's wrath. She was volatile and seemed to be angry about something or other most of the time. There were very few hugs or kisses. She did not act as though she cherished us. She criticized us and ordered us around. If you disobeyed or gave Mama sass, a beating was the consequence. But don't get it twisted. My mama was a great woman. She instilled values in her children that served us well throughout our lives. She was a model of hard work, civic involvement, and of making the best of what you got. She learned from life's hard knocks and wanted us to succeed. She would call us together, sit us down, and tell us the dangers of the world. Education was the only defense. You will go to college and you will finish college. Land in jail and you will stay in jail. I was considered a bad child, quite unruly. I lied, tattled, teased, and yelled, making myself a general nuisance. I'd hit my siblings on their backs and then run and climb onto Mama's lap, thumb firmly planted in my mouth. I lacked companionship. My six sisters and brothers paired up into three couples and avoided me. I felt left out. More than once, I heard one of them introduce our family and end with, "And then there's Jenny." There was little or no discussion why I behaved poorly. No time out in those days. Our parents, our village, grabbed a switch and beat your ass when you were bad, and Mama did not spare the rod. One memorable beating took place when I ruined my freshly pressed hair. On Saturdays, Mama would straighten her five girls' hair and neatly roll it around brown paper strips so we could look our best the next morning in church. Mama finished my hair and sent me to sit quietly on the front porch. But it was so hot, I couldn't resist running through the lawn sprinkler. I heard Mama was looking for me. I crawled into the doghouse and sobbed as my hair went back to the nap. I stayed there until dark. When I emerged and tried to sneak into the house, Mama was waiting with a switch. She whooped me in the street. Now calm down, y'all. It wasn't terrible all the time, or I wouldn't be here, for God's sake. I do have some wonderful memories of my childhood. I always loved our family reunions, the excursions up and down the Mississippi River on the SS Admiral steamboat, and marching with my siblings in the May Day parade. I can still almost feel the sun on my face through the grapevines behind the old church, when my sisters and I hid amongst the vines, laughing and shrieking hysterically as Babra and Larry chased after us riding their hobby horses. I remember Mama had a real fox shawl with a head and paws that fascinated me. When I was very little and Mama wore the stole to church, I'd sit next to her in the pew, toying with the fox's hard little mouth. It was so nice when Mama would break out in her clear soprano. This is my story. This is my song. A very special memory is of Daddy coming around on payday. That is, when he had a job. He'd arrive and call out, "Where's my baby?" He was there every Friday with that money because he knew the mountain of anger he would face from my mother if he didn't show up. There was a story that she had put him out once, and when he tried to sneak back in through a window, she bloodied his poor head with a cast iron skillet. One of my cherished recollections is of tending to my mother when she was sick. I made her a bowl of cornflakes with 6 tablespoons of CNH pure cane sugar from Hawaii and powdered government milk. She said, this is real good, Jenny. A little sweet, but it's really good. I was so proud of my little old self. Looking back, I can see how hard my mother worked to provide for us. But throughout my childhood, she was either emotionally absent or swinging her feelings around like a hammer, figuratively and literally. Sometimes she struck people, especially those who were closest to her, and sometimes she drew blood. Her rage had no end, but then neither did the obstacles she faced. Dorothy May Lewis was never one to mess with. One day when I was about 6, I held my mother's hand as we walked from Miss Wood's store where Mama had bought a bottle of Coca-Cola. If I had been a good girl, I knew she would give me the last swallow, careful not to let me have too much sugar. Well, out of nowhere, her boyfriend, whose name was Jellybean, pulled up in his station wagon and called out for my mother. "Hey, Dorothy, come here." Now, my mother was pretty much the queen of Kinloch, and the one thing you didn't do was summon her to do anything. And y'all want to know where I got it from. My mother ignored Jellybean. He said, "Dorothy, you hear me talking to you?" She stopped. I stopped. I squeezed her hand a little tighter because I knew Jellybean was in trouble. She said, "Go on somewhere else, Jelly. Can't you see I'm with my baby?" Jelly Bean then made the biggest mistake of his life. He pulled the car over to where my mother and I stood, reached out of the window, grabbed my mama's right arm, and said, "You gonna talk to me right now, Dorothy." I was still holding her left hand tightly, aware of the time bomb that was about to explode.